San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody, on this Inauguration Sunday. And my name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast to Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And time to introduce the main man of the hour and my co-host. He is a CPA extraordinaire. He is a marathon runner. He is a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego. And he's a family office expert. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Joe. We're recovering from the cold weather.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So. Hey, we've got such a wonderful guest tonight. I don't think we have time for any small talk. So it is my honor and pleasure to introduce tonight in studio with us, he's the founding father of probably one of the most successful companies in San Diego and anywhere. Their technology is in about every mobile device on the planet. His success in business is only exceeded by his generosity and magnanimous spirit. And his name is Dr. Irwin Jacobs, but he likes to be called Irwin. Irwin, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here with you.
It is an honor and a privilege, isn't it, Richard?
This is quite a treat, especially, I mean, two weekends in a row. You talk about guests. Last weekend, you know, Allegiance and George Takei.
That's right, George Takei. And I did want to ask you, Irwin, a couple of things about Star Trek and Allegiance. First, let's talk about Allegiance, I guess. So you have seen the musical, correct?
I thought it was a wonderful show.
Yeah, and they're heading to Broadway, and you'll have to hear our podcast of that show.
It was rather amazing how one could make a musical out of such a serious topic and still have it be a joy.
That's what I thought. When I first heard they're making a musical about internment camps, I'm thinking of the producers with Mel Brooks. I mean, how are they going to do this? But, I mean, it is a serious historical piece, and interesting the way they use technology in the show with the visuals, the actual, you know, photographs that, as background, et cetera. So I thought that was pretty innovative. And then Star Trek itself. I took a tour of your museum last week and understand your son Paul is quite a Star Trek fan. They had the first flip phones, didn't they?
Right, we had to model it after them.
Did you ever watch the show at all yourself? Or no?
Very occasionally. No, yeah. Paul was the real enthusiast.
Yeah.
And of course we have an X Prize up for $10 million to come up with a device to be able to make measurements on your body and diagnose problems.
Like McCoy, like wave a device in front of you.
Wave a device in front of you.
No, right. You've had hundreds of companies and people apply for that, right?
So far, it looks like it's getting a lot of interest. It's called the Tricorder, I think, from Star Trek.
Huh, how cool is that? Well, let's just back up to the beginning, Irwin, because you were born in Massachusetts, and I was looking on Wikipedia today to find out where is New Bedford. It is the whaling and fishing mecca of the states, but maybe you could talk about your childhood. Who influenced you? How did you get into engineering, all that?
Mm-hmm. I grew up in New Bedford. It had been a very rich city during the 1800s because of whaling, and so it still has a whaling museum there. I remember visiting that when I was growing up. It was on a very steep hill, and when I visited recently, they somehow had leveled the hill off a bit.
Huh.
It just doesn't appear as steep anymore.
It's never the same when we go back, is it?
Things do change. Yeah. But it was an interesting childhood there. I was always interested in science and engineering. I used to build little devices. It was World War II when I was growing up, and so there weren't very many components available. I use wire off of milk bottle caps. I use little batteries and flashlight bulbs. And it used to be fun putting things together
that
way.
You were the Inspector Gadget of your
right
day.
I was also very active in photography, and I actually set up a small studio in an abandoned coal bin and used that to develop films and print pictures for a photographer who had a little store nearby. So I got into entrepreneurship rather early.
Huh. Now, did your family influence you, or is this just your own individual gumption or initiative?
Well, that was my own interest. And, again, a limited amount of material available because of World War II, but that just made you kind of think of how best to use different things.
And went grade school, high school, all in New Bedford?
I graduated high school in New Bedford. And that is a story in its own right. I had a high school counselor, and when I was preparing to apply to college, assuming I would go to MIT or some equivalent school, he advised me that there was no future in science nor engineering. He suggested Bristol Agricultural College, as I recall. I knew that wasn't of interest. My folks at that time had a very small restaurant. And so he said, well, you have to go to Cornell to the hotel school. And so indeed, I applied to Cornell and ended up in the hotel school at Cornell.
And then what happened?
Well, it has one very good effect. My sophomore year, beginning of sophomore year, I met my future wife, so that was very good.
Mm-hmm.
But about that time, I was beginning to think that maybe engineering did have a future and that I would like to switch over. And by the way, I always use this example when I talk to students saying, you know, life has lots of changes in it, prepare for them and take mm-hmm. advantage when you need to.
Good lesson.
Mm-hmm. I managed to convince the dean of students there that I indeed wanted to go from hotel to engineering because everybody else was going the other direction, switch into electrical engineering, and have enjoyed it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And then went to MIT.
When I graduated Cornell, applied to MIT, managed to be accepted and get a fellowship, and went there for my graduate program. By then, we married, and at the same time I received my master's degree, we had our first child. When I received my doctor's degree a couple of years later, we had our second child. So life was moving very quickly at the time.
And you became a professor at MIT.
Right. We thought about whether to go into business or academics.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, took a flight out to the West Coast because we had always heard California would be great. Stopped up at JPL, visited a few other companies here, but then decided to go into teaching. And, of course, there's a lot to be said for a professor. I mean, it's fun to work with students, but, in fact, to really learn a subject, one has to go ahead and teach it.
Mm-hmm.
This was a period when what's called information theory was very active at MIT. In fact, beginning to become active around the world, but treated as something of an applied mathematics. And so another professor, Jack Wozencraft, and myself prepared to teach a senior level course in communications and decided to base it on digital communications and information theory. That led to the first textbook on digital communications, Principles of Communication Engineering, that we wrote together.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that, of course, has set a direction for my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
The father of information theory was Claude Shannon, right?
Claude Shannon was there. Had his office was a couple of doors down from my office.
Oh, really? Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously a fascinating person, really a brilliant person in many different fields, but mm-hmm. particularly information theory. And most of us said that in the filing cabinets in his office that were full of papers that had not been published yet, that if any of us had just a few of those published papers to publish, our careers would be made.
But then you got turned on to San Diego when?
Well, we took a year's leave of absence in the 64-65 academic year from MIT to come out to JPL on a NASA Resident Research Fellowship. We didn't have much money at the time. We did have three children, so we managed to find an old used van that was being sold by a real estate company. There weren't very many at the time. I built a shelf across the back, put a mattress on the shelf, put a tent underneath, and we set off cross-country.
Wow.
Traveled for 3 weeks coming across country, which was actually a wonderful experience for ourselves and for the boys. It's always good to let three active young people out into a campground and let them run around to use up some of that energy. In any case, we spent 9 months out here. We did come down to San Diego, discovered that, thought it was a very interesting city, loved Balboa Park, among other things, and thought it might be a good place to retire sometime.
Excellent. Excellent. And then you became a professor at UCSD, correct?
Well, we took a trip back from California after being out here 9 months, again camped across Canada this time. And just after arriving back in Boston at MIT, I had a call from a former professor at Cornell saying that he's coming out. There's a brand new university just starting in San Diego, UCSD, where I come out and help start engineering. And it was very appealing, but family, friends, career, everything's on the East Coast, so we turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 days, very unhappy with that decision. Really, you know, might be the right time to go to California. Second day, a heavy rainstorm. Came home soaking wet. My wife, we've been looking for a home around the Boston area. Mm-hmm. My wife read a description of what sounded like a wonderful home. I said, let's go look at it tomorrow. She said, only one problem, it's in La Jolla. They had been sending us the La Jolla Light.
Mm-hmm.
So we called up and said, well, if it's still open, out we come. And we camped cross-country one more time to come out to teach here at UCSD.
Wow. And you started teaching there when, 65?
66. 66. Right, September 66.
And then you wrote the textbook that's still in use over there, correct?
The textbook was published in 65. Because of that textbook, of course, a lot of companies and people knew about me and the interest in digital communications. And so I had a very large number of offers for consulting after arriving here.
Mm-hmm.
And you usually consult one day a week while at the university. And I happened to mention that to two friends from UCLA, Len Kleinrock, Andy Viterbi, on a flight down from NASA Ames one day. And they said, perhaps we should start a company and share the consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, fine, as long as I don't have to manage it. And so we started our first company, which is called Linkabit. Well, it started out as consulting and doing a little teaching, actually, to NELC, among other locations. And but it began to grow. And so we began to hire a few full-time people. And finally, I decided I better take a year's leave and get this better organized. Found out that being in business was indeed very interesting as well, and so retired from the university to run Linkabit.
And I'm amazed at how many people I've met over the last 30 years who originated out of Linkabit. It's amazing.
Well, we looked all around the country to find really good people and attracted them to Linkabit. Of course, being here in San Diego was a great advantage of being able to attract people to come and work.
Mm-hmm.
But we always had the attitude, find very good people, give them very interesting things to do, a very good working environment, and mm-hmm. give them a bit of freedom, and quite a bit of freedom, and good things would happen. And
well,
indeed,
we'll
that did.
We'll be free to discuss great. More of that right after we come back from these announcements. Stay tuned. We are back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio, myself, Joe Vecchio, and our very special guest, Dr. Erwin Jacobs, in studio with us. And where do we leave off? With Linkabit, I believe, right, Erwin?
I think so.
And so how did that launch into the development of Qualcomm and Omnitrack?
Well, we did a lot of interesting things at Linkabit. We managed to attract many very good people here, began to, of course, hire graduates from UCSD, from San Diego State, other schools nearby, but also many from outside. And, of course, being in San Diego does help attract people. Mm-hmm. Our approach always was to try to do something innovative, not to make small differences, look for something that would make significant differences. We gave a lot of freedom to employees to come up with very good ideas, a good working environment, and we all worked very hard. Came up with actually some very good equipment for the U.S. government, a satellite terminal, I think still may be in use by all the services. First use of a small computer called a RISC, Reduced Instruction Set Computer, for an actual piece of equipment, as far as I know. So it was quite unique. And we developed satellite to home television, originally for HBO, but then the entire industry picked it up. We developed small aperture Earth terminals. That was first used by Walmart to connect all their stores and warehouses. Sam used to also use it to send out TV broadcasts each Friday to all the employees. So that was a very successful launch. Those businesses are still very much ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided to get some liquidity and a source component, in a sense, to join another company, MACOM. Sold our company in August of 80 to MACOM, And I stayed on until 85. There had been a change of management. It was a little less interesting, even though I was an executive vice president on the board. And so I retired on April Fool's Day, naturally, of 1985. It took a bit of an email message to all the employees to convince them it wasn't an April Fool's Day joke. That took a little bit of thought.
There's some risk in sending those serious messages on April 1st. But.
No question. Retired for 3 months, decided that retirement was not great fun, and on July 1st, started Qualcomm. Did not have any products in mind. We knew we tried to follow the same kind of approach we did at Linkabit, that is, find very good people, try to come up with some innovative ideas, and work hard. And within about 6 months, came up with ideas that have kept us pretty much busy ever since, namely, one of those ideas was our first product, which was OmniTrax, a little satellite communication system for the trucking industry, which gave us our first revenue, and that allowed us to pursue code division multiple access, CDMA, for cell phones, and that, of course, is a very, very large product for us these days.
I took a tour of the museum, and I heard one MIT professor said what you were trying to do was impossible and could not be done. Do you recall this paper?
It wasn't an MIT professor.
Oh, okay.
It was a couple of professors at Stanford, and they said we were violating the laws of physics. And so whenever I give a talk up at Stanford these days, I always point out that, no, CDMA works everywhere in the world except within a 10-mile radius of Stanford.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, that the life lesson there is, you know, don't believe your critics.
Never
right?
Say never. So.
Right. To be fair, I'm sure there are lots of professors at Stanford that didn't take that position.
All right. But we always remember those few. But anyway, so where did you the idea to go from OmniTrax to voice mobile communications and the initial testing of all that? How did that all come about? What was the eureka moment?
Well, one of the early consulting contracts we had was with Hughes, who was trying to develop a mobile satellite communication system, asked us to review the plan that they had submitted to the FCC, see if there might be any improvements that might be made, etc. And after the second meeting, on a drive down from Los Angeles to San Diego, about Oceanside, I think it was, I came up with the realization that perhaps CDMA might be a better approach for mobile communications. We came back, had one of our other engineers, Klein Gilhausen, who contributed to just about everything we did at Linkabit and Qualcomm, asked him to take a harder look at CDMA. A couple of days later, I came back and asked how it was going. He said, "Were you really serious?" In any case, once we began to take a serious look at it, we realized it had all kinds of advantages. Hughes did support us to do a experimental setup to show that it worked somewhat in accordance with our expectations, or very much in accordance. But then they stopped their program because the FCC was going to take several years to approve a mobile satellite system, and we didn't have the funding to continue. We focused in on the OmniTrax product, had our first major sale to Schneider National, which at the time was the largest of the long-distance truck carriers. And that gave us a funds flow to begin to develop CDMA. This was in the fall of 88. In January of 89, so just a couple of months later, before we had really been able to pursue CDMA for much further, the industry had a vote on how to transform from the first generation of cellular, which was based on analog or FM communications, to digital communications. And they had looked at various labs around the world at CDMA and thrown up their hands, either too difficult, wouldn't work, too far in the future, and had focused on either TDMA, time division, or frequency division. I have to be careful with all these names I'll throw out. But we at Linkabit had developed actually the first commercial TDMA phone. And the company we developed that for, a company at the time known as International Mobile Machines, now InterDigital, and a few European companies were very much in favor of TDMA. I think both Motorola and AT&T at the time wanted FDMA. But in any case, TDMA won the vote, very bitter. And so when we came out about 2 months later with the suggestion that perhaps CDMA is the better way to go. Nobody was interested in listening.
Mm-hmm.
It took a few months. We managed to convince the Cellular Telephone Industry Association to set up a meeting in Chicago where we could present information on CDMA. At that presentation, there were probably about 120 or so people from around the world in the various parts of the industry. I thought there was a reasonable chance somebody was going to find a mistake in what we were doing, something we had overlooked, and say, okay, this is the problem. But nobody did. On the other hand, nobody was convinced by a set of view graphs either. And so we then came back and worked really hard for a few months to build a prototype system the way usually startups do. You work day and night and just make sure it gets done.
We'll get more into that, Irwin, when we come back from this break with more of It's Your Money in Your Life. Stay tuned. All right, there's some of that great bonanza music. I'm sure Irwin must have heard this song once before on Sunday nights. But anyway, over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
We want to thank many, many sponsors, including UBS, Mr. Michael Quaranta, Sean Puckett with Regents Bank, Carl Sheeler, the best business valuation guy on the planet with Business Valuations Limited, our favorite CPAs on the planet, Plato Epic CPAs up in Vista, Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics. I do believe the baby's due on January 18th. We've got to get some news on that so our listeners can know. Joel Gruskin, Cost Segregation Initiatives, saving real estate owners tons of money and improving cash flow. And, of course, Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal. All of our sponsors, very much appreciated.
Right, and they can all be found on our website, along with this podcast and all of our great podcasts at iymoney.com.
And all the podcasts are great. Anyway, my daughter Demi, who's 16 and a high school junior, is missing business math class to sit in on this interview. So she's got a really important question to ask Dr. Jacobs. Demi, go ahead. Get right up on the microphone.
Dr. Jacobs, I was wondering how you think technology will affect our daily lives, let's say 20 years from now.
And beyond.
Well, as you know, it's already having a significant effect that's only going to grow. The devices we carry around in our pocket that we call phones, cell phones, are very, very powerful. They have sensors in them that will be able to help us on medical issues. We've been talking about technology helping education for a number of years. This decade is finally going to happen. Certainly over the next 20, I think much of your education from pre-kindergarten through your career time will be delivered virtually, delivered over a wireless device. And so major impact there. Education then, medical care, obviously has had a major impact already on politics, the ability for people very remote areas to communicate. I just came back from Myanmar, Burma, and also from Thailand. And wherever you look, people are on cell phones, and they're just having already an amazing impact. But for many, that is going to be their access to the internet. So the kinds of information that we're able to get, that's only going to increase the computing capabilities that we have available, our entertainment, just about every aspect of our life. One I did mention when I was over in Myanmar had to do with the fact that it's a very agricultural nation, that there's a lot of communications capabilities that will help farmers, help fishermen, and help improve their careers. Again, I think this is only going to increase over these next couple of decades. So technology will continue to improve. As you know, people are growing up that have only been exposed to computers and now to cell phones. They're very used to them, not at all frightened like some of us older folks. And so just going to do amazing things, most of which we still can't anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask you a philosophical question? Because I know you're going to the inauguration here in a few days, actually in about a day. That's on Monday. You mentioned the use of technology in terms of politics and so on. Is there an opposite side or a flip side of that coin? Because I sort of noticed, like in the last election debate and so on, there's almost like this digital barbarism going on because it's so easy to post information anonymously. I mean, I've never believed that the wisdom of the crowd always leads to further enlightenment. Do you ever worry about the opposite side of what technology does in terms of the ability of people to behave in ways that aren't good?
Well, I think with any technology, there's always pluses and minuses. In fact, mm-hmm. with almost everything we do, there's a black and a white and mm-hmm. a gray area in between. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of look for the right spot. I think overall technology is going to have a very make major improvements in our life, but also teaches us to be a little skeptical of everything that we see mm-hmm. on the net, that we hear about over the net, that it's not all correct, that people have different biases, that they have mm-hmm. different approaches, and you have to think more for yourself. So in that sense, technology, even with the misinformation coming over the net, it may have a good impact as far as our education.
Yes, we're getting good and bad information all the time. I mean, if you had listened to those papers that said it was impossible to do your technology, then that was bad information. So, but anyway.
So anyway, you're on your way to the inauguration, right?
Yes, we'll be leaving on Saturday morning.
Be fun.
Have you been to one of these before?
We went to the last one. Hopefully it won't be as cold. Mm-hmm. Boy, it was really cool sitting out there on the mall, but well worth it.
Yeah. How many days do you plan to stay?
We'll be there, I think, through Monday evening. Oh, no, through Tuesday, perhaps.
Tuesday. Go to mm-hmm. a few parties.
Where one son and a few, three grandchildren will be going with us.
Oh, have fun.
Yeah. That'll be great.
Family trip. Well, anyway, there's cold weather in San Diego. We'll get you ready for cold weather in D.C. if it so happens to be.
Maybe warmer. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe warmer, exactly.
Can I ask you, you have a passion, obviously, for the symphony. Have you always had a passion for classical music, and what turned you on to
it? I wasn't very much exposed to it in New Bedford, other than, in thinking back, Walt Disney had come out with Fantasia, and my mother claims I insisted that, or requested, that she take me at least four times to hear that over and over again. So that might be where I picked up a taste for
and ever since
classical
you've been
music. Going through school and graduate school, didn't have enough time in Boston. We did finally, on the faculty, get time to go to Boston Symphony, go out to Tanglewood. As soon as we came out here to San Diego, we did become involved with the San Diego Symphony, with what is now called the La Jolla Music Society. We've just found that, first of all, listening to music gives us great emotional satisfaction, but it's also a good way to forget all the issues and problems of the day and just kind of go off into a different mode of thinking.
Your intellect. I mean, there's studies done now that classical music actually improves your intellect and maybe creative abilities, you think?
There are such claims.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it works for some people. But anyway, thank you, the symphony, when I got to town here, it was going bankrupt every other day, and I know that you've made quite an impact in turning it into one of the better symphonies in the country.
Yeah, it's really a very, very good symphony now, and we'll be making our first visit to Carnegie Hall this coming fall.
Wow.
So that'll be rather special, perhaps, and I think it's going to happen, a trip to Asia as well.
Wow. Well, should we get into Balboa Park a little bit, Richard? What do you say?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about Balboa Park. You know, I'm a long-distance endurance runner, so sometimes I run through the park, and it's not really safe for pedestrians in the park because what to do when you're driving through there is very confusing for people. And so this project that's been hotly debated, I know you're behind what's known as the parking garage and so on. Can you tell us sort of the genesis behind how this got started?
Right. The mayor came to visit me one day to see about raising some funds to remove the parking from Plaza de Panama in getting ready for the centennial celebration. But I told him I really wasn't interested in kind of partial steps, that as long as there are cars going through the plaza, there will be a safety issue, but even more importantly, it just won't have the openness for pedestrians for example, being on the East Prado does give. There's all kinds of life and excitement there. And I thought about it a little further and looked at some maps and then said perhaps we ought to go down the park and take a look. It may be possible to have cars exit the road coming in over the bridge and make a right turn into an existing parking lot and then on into a parking garage, and remove the cars completely, not just from the Plaza de Panama, but from the Plaza de California, which is by the Museum of Man, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful plaza. It was one that the architect was very happy about, mm-hmm. but it's been full of cars ever since, and from the roads and from the esplanade that leads down to the Oregon Pavilion. And so just to open up actually about 6.3 acres of additional parkland strictly for pedestrians. We pursued that, set up a committee to support that idea. Again, there were some, and there remain some, who feel that building the what we call Centennial Bridge is a bit of a problem from a historic point of view. That wall that they are talking about actually hasn't been visible since 1920 because of eucalyptus trees planted by the original architect back in 1914. And so we don't think that's a problem, but we're sympathetic to those ideas. But the huge improvement of getting cars and opening strictly for pedestrians such a large part of the core of the park, I think, overwhelms any of these issues. There has been a court suit that we expect to hear a result in February, and we'll be able to see whether we can pursue proceed ahead or not.
Well, I know behind the Oregon Pavilion, they plan to put the top of the parking lot's going to be a park, so they're adding more green space, which I think is a neat idea. And some of the criticism I hear is that they don't want free parking to go away. So I don't know, maybe if some free parking could be preserved, I don't know. But look, attractions, look at SeaWorld charges for parking. Attractions charged for parking. I mean, we're not the small little town of 100,000 anymore. And I had a real difficult time parking there myself on a Sunday a few months ago.
Oh, it gets impossible.
I had to pay $12 anyway.
Yeah. Most of the parking will be free. I mean, that's not changing. So it's just the parking lot that is behind the Oregon Pavilion that is currently a surface lot, very ugly. We're going to excavate out, have a three-level parking garage, the top of which is level with the Oregon Pavilion, so it makes a very comfortable pedestrian area and pulls the park actually together, makes it very easy for pedestrians to move back and forth, and have a tram system. The pay for the parking will support the tram system, support maintenance, and pay down the bonds that are helping pay for part of the of the garage. It won't actually pay for everything.
It'd be nice to get police on horses back in the park, too. You know, just my opinion.
We had the mayor on here, and he was a big fan. I know the budget isn't there, but maybe if that could be thrown into the mix, at least for the centennial as a nostalgia item, maybe that's something that could be looked at. So.
Right. That's outside our project, but I agree that's always a
just a nice touch. Yeah, nice touch. Very quaint.
But anyway, so...
So I'm curious... What apps do you have on your phone?
I probably use mostly the same ones others do. The schedule, the internet access, Google, or whichever search engine you wish to use. Because my memory is no longer very good. And so I'm continually looking up information over the web. But keep track of stock prices for some reason or other. And weather around the world, because we're always traveling. My wife likes to play games. I don't play games too much on on the phone, but I'm always on email.
Do you still have a role with Qualcomm? I mean, you obviously must be...
Well, I'm now emeritus, but I go to all of the board meetings. I don't have an office there any longer. I do keep up with what's happening in the industry. I still give many talks, both on the technology side and on the business side. And so I do stay very... occupied, and when there are different visitors, I will go in and work with them. I talk with different engineers occasionally about projects they're working on, and so yes, it's hard to get too far away, but I don't get involved at all with any of the day-to-day business.
We'll get back with High Tech Kai. I want to talk about that when we come back from this break. Stay tuned. All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and our special guest, Erwin Jacobs. And Erwin, your son, Gary, and his wife, Jerry Ann, have started High Tech High. What are your thoughts about that? I think it's a wonderful operation.
Well, a number of years ago, we were very concerned about the fact that so few of our students, our children, were choosing to go into what I call now STEM subjects and science, technology, engineering, math. And what might one do about it? One thought I had was that we should invite all fifth graders in the city to come to Qualcomm, but not to see the laboratories, simply to wander around the parking lots and see the kind of cars they could afford if they studied for engineering. any case, we haven't done that. But motivation is important. So we thought of this idea of setting up High Tech High. Gary took the lead on that. He was still at Qualcomm at the time. And worked to, first of all, find someone to direct that. And luckily, we found Larry Rosenstock, who's done an absolutely superb job. And started the first high school. Now there are 5 high schools, 4 middle schools, a grade school. We're about to add 2 more grade schools.
And international.
And we also have a graduate program. And so it's been very successful. As you know, students are accepted on the basis of a lottery by the different zip codes. So it's very uniform around the city. But about 100% of the kids do graduate, go on to mostly 4, some 2-year colleges, and 1/3 are taking STEM subjects in college. So in that sense, it's been very successful. It's based on using projects to educate. And so students tend to work together in small groups. And I think that's part of the issue. I think this peer-to-peer communication, if somebody's having a little trouble, the teacher might help, but also likely another student's going to step in and say, hey, you know.
And even the courses are team-taught, right? I mean, it's all the teachers collaborate.
Right, and they're often teachers from physics and art or music and science. And so different areas trying to bring the subjects together. We have a number of art pieces at Qualcomm that were done in a math class. And so they're nice art, but they illustrate a theorem.
I just think promoting collaboration is so key because it's traditionally not done well with most education. And, well, you're living proof. I mean, what you accomplished with Linkabit, with Qualcomm, that was all about collaboration.
Yes, you don't want to be siloed. You want to be open to new ideas, to putting different aspects together. And by the way, San Diego itself as a region is probably better at collaboration in many different areas than most parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And for example, I'm now chairman of Salk Institute, and we've collaborated with other institutions in the area, and among other things have 4 institutions got together, raised money from the stem cell state organization to build a building, and now a number of different scientists from different groups are working there. And so there's just been great collaboration. The university, of course, really supports this very strongly, and so we're all benefiting from that.
And you made the conscious decision to grow your company in San Diego. We always hear people, oh, there's too much regulation in California, too much taxes, this, that, but obviously...
you want good people to work with you. There's no better place than California, San Diego. We're up to about 23,000 employees. A little over half are here in San Diego. We're still growing in San Diego. And I'd say one of the most significant problems is resource, and it's human resources, getting people who are well-trained and able to come and work with the company. And that's why we're so focused on education. This country, of course, has made really a very bad decision for a number of years and still haven't fixed it on immigration. We have many students at our universities from other countries studying here, getting their degrees here, wanting to remain here and work with us, but we can't get visas. So we force them to go back to their original countries and work for either a competitor, or we have to set up a laboratory there so they can work for us at that location. And so that's something that really does need to be changed.
Yeah, this country also made a bad decision when the research and development credit wasn't effective for a year or two. Fortunately, it's back in now. But I don't know how we're going to compete unless we have things like that
in
place.
Even more so, we're cutting down support for research universities, for research institutions. And it's so critical that we provide that support at the federal level as well as at some of the state levels. California has been very good, but most states are not. And so that fundamental research is what leads a couple of years out to new innovations, new products, economic growth. And if you look and see, for example, the impact that Qualcomm has had on this region, there was just a study done. I was amazed by it myself that about $4.5 billion of our county GNP product is generated by Qualcomm and the impact of Qualcomm on the area.
That is incredible.
Each year.
That's incredible. Let me put you on the spot. because we're almost out of time. So what hasn't been invented yet, technologically speaking, that needs to be invented?
Well, again, we mentioned before the impact on health, and so devices that will provide even better ways to monitor health, provide improved results at lower cost. I think we still have to do that much better. By the way, that's using sensors of different types. Those sensors will also be monitoring the environment around us, whether any issues with health, with noise, with environmental dirt, whatever, make that information available in large databases. And the so-called mining of the databases, this handing large amounts of data, is going to be another major growth area. How do we really pick out trends from this massive information that we're rapidly accumulating?
And fascinating. How many patents does Qualcomm have? They must have...
So I can't keep up the number. It's approaching 10,000, maybe one way or another. In that,
there you go. Well,
it's growing rapidly.
We won't hold you to a specific number on that. But if you get over to Qualcomm, the corporation, and get into their museum, highly, highly recommended. Anyway, Irwin, we just have to thank you on behalf of San Diego for all you and Mrs. Jacobs have done and your family. It's just been a magnificent treat to have you with us today. And
Put one more plug in then.
Okay.
We'll be opening the new Central Library in July.
Absolutely.
And if you haven't visited it yet, you can go down and visit.
Oh, it's an amazing place.
Very special place.
We'll be there. Dr. Jacobs, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Very much appreciated.
Yeah, Demi, thanks for being here. Richard, you have a great week. We'll see you next week on more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Take care now. Good night.
We lead the conversation. Follow us, 760
Mike Slater here for Newman Windows, your trusted source for windows and doors. So it's 2013. Start the new year off right with some new windows from Newman Windows. And if you purchase by the end of the month, you get $300 off on any purchase of $2,500 or more, or 6 months, same as cash. Now, you've heard me talk about Newman Windows and the Newman Advantage, the best customer service you'll ever receive. This will be the easiest home improvement project you'll ever make. I've toured their headquarters. They run the entire operation like clockwork, which means a better experience for you. They're going to work around your schedule. They have the most installation experience, and they're going to meet or beat any competitor's price. So make it your New Year's resolution to finally purchase those beautiful new windows that you've been wanting and that you've been meaning to get. And it's going to make your home more energy efficient, so it's going to save you a lot of money as well. Call Newman Windows today. Take advantage of these huge savings if you purchase before January 31st. If you're in North County, 760-438-8080. The Marina Boulevard showroom is 619-276-6500. And wherever you are, Newman Windows.
We follow the story.
If there's even one thing we can do, if there's even one life that can be saved,
then we lead the conversation.
And we've got an obligation to try.
Follow the leader. 760.